When I turn to 2 Samuel chapters 12 and 13, and read those chapters, I imagine a brokenhearted, slumped over king on the throne. He's now all alone. Samuel, God's representative, has come and brought him devastating news. News of how unhappy God is with David. His attempt to cover up his lusting, his adultery, and the murder of Uriah the Hittite didn't work. It failed. God cannot be fooled. And so he sent Nathan to talk to him, tell him a story. Who was Uriah the Hittite? He was one of David's commanders, one of his powerful soldiers. He's listed in the Hall of Fame of the people who built, that helped David build his kingdom in 2 Samuel chapter 23. He was married to the beautiful Bathsheba. Her father, I believe this connection is correct, at least my view. Her father, Eliam, was also in the Hall of Fame. He was a fellow soldier, probably an older man, older warrior than Uriah. He was the son of Ahithophel. That meant, if I'm right about that, then Bathsheba was the granddaughter of Ahithophel. And this explains why Ahithophel turned against David when Absalom rebelled. There was no reason to give up a plush job like he had and to support this rash young person who wanted to be king, but he did. In any case, David made every effort. Even when he found out that Bathsheba was pregnant, instead of going to God, instead of calling in Nathan, instead of praying, he decided to use his powers to bring Uriah the Hittite home from the battlefield. They were fighting at a place called Rabbath Ammon that some of our people got to visit on the recent trip. It's now called Ammon, Jordan. Uriah came home, but would not go to his house. His soldiers could not be with their wives. He refused to. David even got him drunk the next night, and that didn't succeed. So David hatched a plot, and that plot would involve Joab's men pulling back and leaving Uriah there on the slope by himself, and he was killed in battle. But his clever plot did not work. Nathan had told David a story, a true story. We frequently label it as one of the few Old Testament parables, but it was a story, basically a true story, where David was disguised as a rich man. And that rich man had all kinds of sheep. And there was a poor man in the story who had only one lamb. And a guest came, and that rich man took the poor man's lamb. And David was furious when he heard the story. What Nathan was doing was building a parabolic mirror so David could see the story and look into the mirror. But he just didn't seem to get it. And Nathan said, "You're the man. You are the person in the story." And God is disappointed. God's brokenhearted. The Saracen story is kind of downplayed in VeggieTales. I don't know if you have watched VeggieTales with your children or grandchildren, but starting about 14 years ago, Dorian and I, our great nephew, stayed a lot with us, and he and I watched VeggieTales until we were blue in the face. We watched King George and the Rubber Ducky. And I see some of you have seen King George and the Rubber Ducky. But the story's played down. The impact, what George did in the story, is nothing compared to what David did. But one thing I liked about it was the flannel board presentation. The wise man came in. He's representing Nathan the prophet, and he puts the rich man there and the sheep and the poor man and the sheep. And then he King George doesn't get it like David did. And he puts a crown on the head of the king, and suddenly he got it. And David got it. And now Nathan is gone, and David is by himself. And David is, I can only imagine what happened, but I imagine him sitting there on the throne. Tears had to be rolling down his cheek. How he had trusted God in his youth and in his early days in the Valley of Elah and other places, how he trusted God, and how now he had broken God's heart. I'm sure he sat there thinking about the days when he was faithful, when he didn't have to hope that he would win a battle. He expected to win. And to me, that's the way I preach the Greek word elpis in the New Testament. God, you don't expect to. I never expected most of the time I never hoped to pass a test when I prepared for the test. I expected to pass the test. We recently were in the Valley of Elah, and we went in the Brook of Elah, and we had several people picked up stones to bring back. This is one that came from the Valley of Elah, one of my favorite stones there. I don't know if David had any stones in his palace where he kept things, souvenirs like this. But I do remember that when David walked out of the front of that fortress, which we now know as the Two Gates, and that's what it was called in 1 Samuel 17, and he walked out that front gate after talking to Saul and after convincing him that God had been with him when he killed the lions and the bears, and he didn't hope to kill the lions and the bears, he expected to. And he didn't hope to kill Goliath, he expected to. Because he so told Saul that God can do anything. And he knew he and God, God being the big partner, would defeat Goliath. And even after things turned sour, though the people anointed David and thought with being the new darling of the Israelites, Saul became jealous. And as Saul pursued him and tried to kill him and tried to get Jonathan to help him, David went from place to place, the beautiful oasis of Engedi to the wilderness in the south, even over to Moab. He took his parents to the king of Moab because of the connection with Ruth. Ruth was Jesse's grandmother, David's great-grandmother. But he takes him to the king of Moab for safekeeping. And God always watched after him. And whenever he got in trouble in his outlaw days, he turned to God. And God responded to that. Even when his men were angry at him on one occasion and wanted to stone him because of a decision David made, he quickly turned to God and inquired, "What should I do?" And this was the David that I'm sure he thought about time and time again. The story I'm telling you this morning is one I don't like. I've spoken around the country. I've spoken in Great Britain at the British Museum. I've spoken in Israel on the historicity of David, on his heroic acts, what a great person and king he was, and how he was made a lot of mistakes, but was devoted to God. But this part of the story is hard. And yet this part of the story is the part we neglect, and the part we need to hear, the part that VeggieTales kind of slip by the real essence. Maybe that's as much as they should have done, and the child would learn more later. But this story needs to be heard. I don't know when David wrote Psalm 51. I do know what the heading says, and I'll give you my own interpretation of the heading. You turn to Psalm 51. Here we find that verse 1, which is the heading is verse 1 in the Hebrew Bible, I believe. A Psalm of David. When Nathan the prophet came to him, and I translate the last part, interpret the last part, after the Bathsheba-Uriah affair. And listen to how it started. He had to be thinking these words sitting there on the throne, or they came to him pretty quickly. Have mercy on me, O God, according to your steadfast love. Steadfast love. We have some visitors today. One of them is Ken Mick and his son Lincoln sitting right behind Juanita and Sue there. And I do see a lot of other happy faces that I haven't seen in a while. Sue, I'm glad to see you. And I'm sure Ken heard me lecture on Chesed, and I'm sure he's lectured on Chesed. He's been preaching a long time. He's 62, aren't you? Doesn't look a day over 42. I'm 82, and people tell me I don't look a day over 81. But I'm sure he heard about Chesed in my class, Clyde Miller's class, in many classes. I'm sure he's taught on Chesed. It's a word that's really hard to translate. It means, the president of Hebrew Union, where I got my doctorate, wrote a dissertation saying it meant covenant loyalty. Everybody doesn't agree with that, but I like the idea. It can be translated grace. It's translated true love, loving kindness, mercy in Psalm 23. It's just a powerful, powerful word. Forgive me according to your steadfast love. According to your abundant mercy, blot out my transgressions. And then he goes on to say he knows his transgressions now. He's turned his back on them. He knows them. Wash me and I shall be whiter than snow in the end of verse 7. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and put a new and right spirit within me. And then verse 11 just tears my heart out. Cast me not away from thy presence, and take not thy Holy Spirit from me. And then the third verse from the end, the sacrifice acceptable to God is a broken spirit. Not some big ox or some perfect animal, but a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart, O God, thou shalt not despise. I don't know when he wrote that, but it does tell me that, and Nathan tells me also in chapter 12, as he tells David, God, he will forgive him. God will forgive him if he will turn to him. And it's very clear that he did turn to him. And so, again, I don't know when he wrote Psalm 32, but I know he had to be saying something like Psalm 32. And so let's take a quick look at it when this happened to him. Psalm 32, after he had come to grips with the fact that God was willing to forgive if he would repent, and he did. Blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Oh, that's powerful. That's so powerful. In verse 3, when I declared not my sin, my body wasted away through my suffering all day long. For day and night your hand was heavy on me. My strength was dried up as by the heat of summer. I acknowledged my sin to thee, and I did not hide my iniquity. And then, of course, he talks about how he confessed, and then you did forgive the guilt of my sin. That may have been written shortly after that. I don't know, but it's the same kind of expression David would have had. And even though I really sometimes find displeasure in teaching this part of David's life, it's necessary. It's very necessary. And it's clear to me that God forgave him. We'll talk about that more in a minute. But there are clear lessons to be learned. Number one, God knows what we need. God knows what's best for us. God knows that how sin can destroy us. His instructions, his Torah, I have to mispronounce it, Torah, or some of my students don't think I know Hebrew, but his Torah, his guidance, we translate it law, but his instruction, I believe is from an Aramaic word meaning to show the way, to guide. Therefore, his guidance. This is for our well-being. The second thing is we see that God is a forgiving God. He is a God of chesed, no doubt about it. When I teach the Gospels, I love to teach Luke. In fact, I love to teach all the Gospels, but I love to teach Luke especially because it's filled with parables of grace. And one of my favorites, which is unique to Luke, is the parable of the so-called prodigal son or the lost son. I call it the parable of the waiting father. I see the waiting father there with his arms outstretched. And when he sees the glimpse of his son coming over the hill, he runs to him and he does several things, but the thing that stands out the most is he kisses him again and again and again. It's the word kata phileo. Phileo can be translated to kiss, to be fond of, to love, but kata phileo is an intensifying word that tells us about the grace of God and the nature of God. He really wants us to be forgiven. And he's willing to give us what we need, not what we deserve. What we need. He gave David what he needed, not what he deserved. David still is going to suffer the consequences. That's my next point. It's extremely clear that we may suffer severe consequences for our actions. We can be forgiven and still suffer those consequences, and there are our consequences. Our grandson, you've probably heard me mention once or twice if you've been in any class. I remember when David, my son, was born 43 and a half years ago. And I think every day in class, I came to class, I talked about David. And I walked in one day and I saw there was a sign on somebody had written on the board, "Welcome to David 101. And I never changed. I kept on talking about David. And the same thing about my grandson, Duncan. Big-time soccer player. Loves soccer. But the story's not about that today. It's about his teammate, London Baronis. Some will recognize the name Baronis from his father, Rob Baronis, who was 9 years a kicker on the Tennessee Titans. And Rob lost it one night. And if you read on the internet, you'll see road rage and people calling the police. You'll see his father saying what he thought he had gotten into alcohol. He normally didn't do that. But whatever the case was, he turned off of Franklin Road, I think, onto Battery Lane and was going so fast he didn't make it and died in the hospital. That was 3.5 years ago. Little London, wonderful little soccer player, wonderful personality, sweet kid, handsome little boy. Walked in yesterday. We were having an indoor soccer tournament that he and Duncan were involved in. They normally play together in the fall and spring on the Tennessee soccer premium team in Franklin Brentwood. And he said, "Oh, I'm chilly," he said, "Mr. Cloud." And I said, "Well, come over here. Let me give you a hug." I give him a hug every time I can because his mother's there and very, very dedicated to him, but I did not see anyone else. I know at the funeral, at least one football player said, "We'll be with you." And maybe they have been. I don't know that for a fact. But I do know I've never seen any of them, any grandparents, at the soccer matches the last 2 years. So I give him a hug every time I can. Because the consequences of what his dad did, for whatever reason, will always be felt. He has his mom. She's very loving. Duncan has his mom, Michelle, his father, David, his grandmother, Juanita, and me. We're there just about every time we can be there for him. David let his children, of course, see, or his children saw what he did, and they believed they could do whatever they wanted to. So Amnon prepares to revolt and prepares horses and chariots, and you can tell he's chopping at the bit to be the king, but he makes a mistake of seducing his half-sister and ruining her life. And her full brother, Absalom, then made sure that he didn't see the light of day after that and killed him and went into exile. Absalom came home from exile. He himself began, once he got back in the favor of David, began plotting against his own father and went to Hebron and declared himself king. But eventually he died in battle, and One of the things you'll remember from the battle with David versus Absalom was David sitting on the steps, front steps, at the gate of the city of Mahanaim over in Jordan, weeping, weeping. Oh, my son Absalom. And I know he had to, and he wished he had died in Absalom's stead. And I know he was thinking, and had thought many, many times, had thought when all this was happening, if I just stayed on track, if I just showed the faithfulness of God that I should have, all these things would not be happening. The fourth and maybe the most important point is, out of all of this, is there's real hope. Oh, you can talk about David killing Goliath with a stone like this, and that's a wonderful, wonderful story and a heroic act. But where we fall mostly is in the area where we spiritually are sick. And maybe your problem is something else. Maybe it's a financial problem, but there's a way out of that. Maybe it's somebody you love went to prison, or like our Kimberly, who came out of that in a marvelous way because it never gave up hope. Or like our Grant Carey, who works with us and who's involved in the prison ministry, and how he shot his best friend four times over a girl when he's 17. And now he's the assistant director of the CC Prison Outreach Ministry. He served as a chaplain at Sumner County Jail. He went to Israel with me, and he's changed his life completely because someone showed hope. Someone handed the New Testament to him in Indiana through the bars and said, "Master this book and you won't have to master any other." Kimberly had the love, incredible love of this congregation, the love of her mother and father, and saw hope. And just a few weeks ago, was happily married. After a successful, she's still in college, they worked on a master's degree, but turned her life around because hope. Out of despair, out of the depths of despair, she came back, and Grant came back, and David came back. I know God forgave him, and I know God, the scriptures kept talking about the promise that God made in chapter 7 of 2 Samuel about the Messiah coming, and David would be the ancestor of that Messiah. And that spark must have helped David. That hope of the future and something better must have helped him through those really horrible last few years of his life. I know he had to be saved. And God had forgiven him because the scriptures tell us that. And so there's much hope there. My favorite song, or one of my, I guess, two favorite songs, is Rock of Ages. And I asked Blake if he would lead it as the invitation today. And we frequently sing, song leader sings verse 1 and skip verses 2 and 3. Blake's going to sing all three as the invitation. I want you to look at 2 and 3 though. And when you sing them with the understanding of what God can do for us. Nothing, not the labor of my hands can fulfill the law's demands. You just keep law after law after law, and you should. But that's not to be saved. It's because you are in the right relationship with God. Could my zeal no respite know? Could my tears forever flow? All for sin could not atone. Thou must save, and thou alone. Verse 3. Nothing in my hand I bring, simply to thy cross I cling. Naked come to thee for dress, helpless look to thee for grace. Vile I to the fountain fly. Wash me, Savior, or I die. That's God's invitation as we stand and sing.